We are in North Ossetia, in the Caucasus Mountains, where beautiful people have been coming together to celebrate ancient traditions since the beginning of time itself, where everything has a special symbolic meaning. I'm Sean Thomas, this is Inland Visions, and today we are discovering the world of Ossetian culture.
We are heading to the City of the Dead, a mysterious medieval village called Dargafs that is heaped in myths and legends. In years gone by, it was claimed those who visited would never emerge alive, but we'll take our chances.
This place is fascinating. There's an incredible energy here. It kind of feels like we're going back into the ancient times, if you will. Where are we exactly? What is this place?
As a matter of fact, this is an ancient or medieval cemetery. But the way it is arranged is absolutely unusual. What we have here are the so-called vaults. They were supposed to be eternal houses for the deceased. And I believe that all the things that have flower of eternity are impressing every person that gets into there, under their influence.
Now, in terms of cities of the dead, this gorge is one of the biggest in Ossetia. In terms of the crypts themselves inside, some of the people laid to the rest are in boat-like structures even. I can't help but think about the River Styx and Greek mythology. Are they related? How does something from Greek mythology end up all the way here in Ossetia?
Greek mythology is also of Indo-European root. Mm-hmm. And the Ossetians belong to the Iranian branch of that historical cultural community. And in this sense, of course, we have relation. But to my mind, those coffins were the cattle feeders. Mm-hmm. And as cattle feeders, they have the idea of eternal life. Mm-hmm. And to make the picture more convincing, I should say that when a woman was giving birth to a newborn child, she would also lay down into this feeder. And then this feeder becomes the place where the past and future meet each other.
Now, strategically located, is this place symbolic even in its placement? In our conversation before, you were talking about we're really at the center of the universe.
Exactly. And that center is just at the right side of my hand. This is Tbau Hoch. Mm-hmm. Hoch in Ossetian means mountain. Tbau is the personal name, and it is connected with legends, with riots, which are very important in Ossetian ethnic cultural tradition.
Mm-hmm. What about these towers that we see everywhere, or family towers? What do they mean? I mean, they're everywhere in terms of when you're going through the mountains here.
Family towers were sort of a castle. Mm-hmm. They were erected to be a fortification construction for the family. Mm-hmm. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, they were also sacred, as they were symbolizing mountains, and sometimes they were used for worship, as in epic tradition we read that famous Shatana would bake three pies, mm-hmm. go up to the tower and pray to the god. Mm-hmm. Thus she was closer to heaven.
So I've heard this phrase when doing research for this program, that you can't build a tower from a ruined village, but you can build a village from a ruined tower. What does that mean?
That means that Kiru should be attributed to the human beings, to people. If there are no people, there is no use of any tower, and you cannot erect it. I guess the general idea is that without people, there is no life, there is no community, there is no tower.
Mm-hmm. What about some of these towers date all the way back to the 15th century? They're very old. Some families are trying to restore their towers, some are building new towers. What does it mean for a family to actually have a tower?
That was a symbol of their high social status. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that easy. We are used to modern buildings, and we arrogantly look down at this archaic towers made of simple stones. Yet it needed several years to erect such a tower, and it needed very masterful builders, because the technique itself required certain qualities that today we do not even realize.
Now, I know that here in Osetia they worship Christianity, there's also Islam, and there's also their own Ossetian religion as well. Is it true that a Orthodox Christian and Muslim can sit at the same table after worshiping and not have any problems?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the idea underlying this fact is that Ossetian tradition adopts both Christianity and Islam mm-hmm. within the frame of the so-called Indo-European cult of hero. And the idea underlying this cult is the readiness of the hero to sacrifice one's own life in favor of the community, in favor of the humankind. Mm-hmm. From this point of view, they thought that Jesus Christ, as a survivor, was the hero who was ready to die to save the others. And the rite of sacrificial animal is also a practical manifestation of this idea. In Islam, there is Kurban Bayram, which also manifests the same idea. And there were families where one brother would go to the church, another would go to more to the mosque, and going back home in the evening, they would assemble around traditional three pies and pray to God Almighty, and there was absolutely no problem.
This synergy of religion and culture, could you say that that's the basis of what it means to be Ossetian?
To my mind, it is. Mm-hmm. The basic idea being that there are different ways that lead to one and the same goal, that is, the God Almighty.
Mm-hmm. And for you personally, someone who's lived here, you're from here, you've studied the history here, what does it mean for you when I say Ossetia?
It is motherland. It is the place where I belong. And it is the place where the world mountain, that is the center of the universe, is situated.
Right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
When you drive through the mountains of North Ossetia, you come across these giant installations every now and again. They are almost like Easter eggs that serve people with a little reminder of where they are. We're off to meet Artur Bizikov, the man behind this project.
Thank you for meeting us out here. This is really a beautiful piece. So I have to ask, is this just a piece of art, or is there more meaning behind it?
We created these sculptures and installations to capture the various aspects of Ossetia's history through contemporary art, through symbolism, as it were. In this particular work of art, the diphthong E carries a lot of symbolic significance for us.
So if the meaning is to promote Ossetian culture, how does a letter or a wheel or a giant cornucopia achieve that task?
Since we've built these pieces, a lot of tourists have been coming to take pictures. Some are more popular than others. The wheel, for example, is so massive, it just draws people to it. Besides, it also represents the wheel of samsara, a symbol of eternity, of life, and lots of visitors like taking pictures around it. As for the cornucopia, or the horn of plenty, we created it because our grandfathers and grandmothers, back when we were small, had these horns hanging on the walls. It meant that every household had their own abundance of something. And now, decades later, most people have either thrown these horns away or lost them, lost this valuable piece of history. So, the abundance it symbolized for every family has moved on somewhere, crossed over into modernity. That giant horn we installed on the side of the rock is to honor the memory of our grandparents. One time we saw older people heading up there, and when they saw the horn, they pointed at it and said, "We used to have a horn like that at home." We were so happy to hear that. It meant that we basically achieved the goal we set out for this art piece. In our workshops, we follow a sort of strategy or approach to make pieces of art, which, while modern, still have a certain sense of history to them, a sense of the old. We try to combine these two forms. The same goes for our sculptures and installations. These are pieces of modern art, yes, but our letters also have a national significance for us, an historical significance. And the same is true of the Kisin Fandir. It's an ancient musical instrument as well, but it's made in a kind of a modern style.
Now, you have said that you have a dream to create a symbol that would unite all of Ossetia. What would that symbol look like?
We've got quite a few workshops here in Ossetia, so we can pool resources for joint projects. One place makes a leg, the other a hand, etc. And then you just bring these workshops together and complete it. Now, what exactly could we choose for the art piece? It could be a nart, a hero of Ossetian folklore. We could choose a specific character from the narts. Then we have art schools of all levels participate in the project to bring people together and organize a competition for the best design. We then select one and start on the project.
You're an artist. Obviously, you have pride in Ossetia because you've created this project. What does it mean for you to have something like this as a representation, as an artist, here in Ossetia, personally?
You know what's the most important thing we get out of this? When you're a kid, your parents often feel anxious about what you're going to be when you grow up. I had a team of about 8 people, and after the objects were installed and the project got a lot of attention, I found out that the parents of my team members were really happy. They approached me personally as the creator of these objects and told me that they're so proud to see what their children are doing. Hearing those parents' words meant more to my heart than anything, more than having my name on the thing.
Music is an important part of Ossetian culture, and making musical instruments is a sacred act. For many years, the Fundir factory has been making and renovating musical instruments according to ancient rules, techniques, and traditions. Tamerlan, I know that you follow the most ancient rules and techniques and traditions for making your instruments. What are some of the most important ones?
When we started our work, we knew that these instruments were authentic, because Ossetians have very few of them left. Many of the instruments that existed did not survive the Mongol invasion. People had forgotten their sound. We knew that the Kishin Fandir and the Dala Fandir would be carved from solid wood. To make these two instruments resonate, craftsmen originally used leather, because they couldn't make other materials work at the time. We also started with leather resonators, but we realized that the exact sound had been lost over time, so we couldn't make them sound like they should. In the end, we started making the deck out of wood.
Something that I found incredibly interesting is that a luthier has to have an incredible reputation, meaning that you can't be sullied by crime or have your name hurt in any way. So, in terms of being an instrument maker, doesn't being an incredible craftsman simply being enough? Or why do you have to have such a good reputation?
That's an interesting thought. I think it was people with highly developed musical senses who had the requisite qualities in the first place. They had to be pure of soul and mind, as it's said in the Nart sagas. The sagas speak of Adsamas, a creator of instruments, who produced sounds so noble that the musician seemed incapable of any wrongdoing. The oldest instrument we have today is said to have been created by a Nart named Sirdon, who returned from a long journey to find his children killed. He didn't know why and was beside himself. He took the hand of his eldest son to make the neck of an instrument, and used some of the other bones to make the resonator part. That's how he used the remains of his children to create the instrument known as the Duodastanon. The depth of its sound and its ability to express sorrow were so great that it became the most popular instrument among Ossetians for centuries. And the idea that the luthier must have a pure heart and mind is always present in Nart tales.
What about the type of wood that you use? Is there any specific wood, or is it just any generic wood might work?
Traditionally, of course, we continue what's been done for centuries. We have maple, sycamore maple. So the deck, the body part, is made out of that. We use the spruce for resonance, so we haven't moved away from some of the canons of instrument making. Pear used to be popular, and it was necessary for resonance. Wild pear and mulberry, because of the composition of the wood, held sound well. Today we've come to the point where the body is made of maple and the resonator is spruce.
What about the preparation for the wood? Do you have to do anything special to it? I heard that sometimes you might even have to boil it. Is that true?
Certainly. Hardwoods must be boiled to extract the excess sap. It becomes more porous, which means it reflects sound well. For exclusive models, we dry the wood naturally for 5 or 6 years. But the wood we boil is beech and maple. We boil it because it gives a clearer sound reflection. Stradivarius liked to use spruce from Georgia for the body. The wood exported to Italy was mostly from the northern slopes of South Ossetia. The spruce trees that grew there had good sound reflection. So he loved that type of wood and spent a lot of money to get it from here. So we're also taking advantage of this.
I know that there are a lot of different superstitions and traditions about these instruments. For example, being able to tell the weather from how the instrument looks. Can you talk to me about that?
It's an interesting question. The practice, though, only involves this instrument, the Kishin Fandir. Animal skin is tightly stretched to produce the right temperament. To prevent it from shrinking, they used to heat it up from time to time. However, when the weather changed, the instrument would shrink a little all the same. This happened due to increased moisture in the air and condensation. Ossetians could tell the instrument had shrunk by the sound it produced, which also meant the weather was changing. People might not feel it in their bones, but the instrument would always respond to changing weather. Another important aspect is that the sound pitch, or the frequency of the string, was used to rescue people from under landslides or avalanches. Bad weather can cause snowdrifts here. If someone went hunting or to fetch hay, they could end up under one. This instrument is the one tool used to find them. Rescuers would play it over the snow, testing its depth. You see, when there was a cavity beneath, the string started to sound different. So they dig in that spot and recover people. This method is described in many sources. Many people know about it. So again, only the Kishin Fandir was used for that. A change in its string pitch indicated that there were people trapped under the snow. We haven't done this with our instruments, but the fact is it's part of our history. It's in our folk tales, in our sagas. They'd play one note like this, again and again. And a slight change in the pitch would tell them there was a person under the snow. That's what they used to do.
Now, something I found fascinating is that I heard that to get the right kind of wood, you have to pick wood that is on the southern-facing slope of a mountain. Is this true, and why?
Yes, that's true. The distance between the growth rings of a sawn tree is important. Why? The Japanese were the first to prove that equal spacing between tree rings, when tangential cuts are made, provides superb sound reflection. It's correct what you said. It's a very important detail. This needs to be taken into consideration when the wood is cut. The spaces between the tree rings should be perfectly equal. Then the sound is echoed properly, because this boosts the vibrational properties of the wood.
Mm-hmm. How long does it take to make an example? For example, this one right here. How long does it take you to make from beginning to end?
This instrument here was made from a hollowed-out block of wood. Cutting the body from wood is a traditional technique that we use. It took us 2 months to make it. You have to be very careful when removing wood from the sound box to ensure universal wall thickness. It's vital for even and proper sound reflection. So it took us around 2 months to craft this instrument.
I understand that this is not your specific instrument, but you do play. Do you mind demonstrating what you can do?
I'm not that good with the bow, but I can show you something on a plucked string instrument. This Dala Fandir here. That's it.
Excellent. Excellent.
Ой, чужигай, расшук, чужигай, о. Олхожаны чужиг, расшук, чужигай, о. Ой, чужигай, расшук, чужигай, о. Колхожаны чужиг, расшук, чужигай, о. Жарак дымга, наратоне фажаго. Жаде манаута не файлава, о. Жарак дымга, наратоне фажаго. Жаде манаута не файлава, о.